It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Governor Tony Evers this month appointed 25 members of a new task force to examine challenges in Wisconsin's healthcare workforce. He announced the initiative as part of his State of the State address while declaring 2024 the Year of the Worker. To oversee the new task force, Evers is tapping his second in command, Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez. I spoke Friday with Rodriguez about leading this work, and I first asked her about priorities for the group of hospital executives, state government leaders, researchers, activists, and others.
So we're going to be looking at the healthcare workforce really comprehensively all across the state of Wisconsin. We know we've got some good news here, which is we've got a very low unemployment rate, but we've got some work to do. I'm a nurse myself, and I know that we are going to be short about 20,000 nurses by 2040. That's a huge issue for our healthcare system, for our hospitals, for our clinics. We want to make sure people can get the care that they need where they live, and that's what this healthcare workforce task force is really going to be looking at.
As that registered nurse background and having the healthcare executive background for patient care management, I wonder how has that affected your priorities about policy decisions, but also what this task force is capable of?
So I have a very long background in healthcare, in nursing, and in public health. And so that is going to really change my perspective on what we're looking at, because we not only need nurses within the healthcare systems themselves, like the hospitals and clinics, but public health needs nurses as well. Public health needs healthcare providers. Plus, we know that there are other shortages across the state. I've been talking to hospital systems, dental clinics, long-term care, all across the state of Wisconsin, and I know that they are struggling to find other types of positions within their healthcare systems. So how do we encourage people to get in the pipeline to be able to get these really great careers in Wisconsin in healthcare? And also, how do we retain the people that we have here? Let's work on making sure we can keep the folks that we have here in Wisconsin.
What voices and experiences and backgrounds are critical to be represented on this type of task force, a task force on the healthcare workforce?
So we have a very broad range of folks who we've asked to be on the task force. That goes from hospital systems to people who are actually working on the ground, CNAs within the workforce today. We've got folks from long-term care. We've got folks from our federally qualified health centers. We've got dental. We've got the educational system. So being able to look at the whole system comprehensively is something that I'm really excited about being able to do. So we can put in some solutions today that we can recommend to the governor and then look at it long term. How are we going to make sure that we don't have this gap in the future?
You've mentioned the crunch in nursing. And last year, the Wisconsin Hospital Association found vacancy rates for hospital professionals grew more than 4 percentage points between 2020 and 2021. And this report also says that Wisconsin's healthcare workforce can't grow fast enough. Why might hospitals be leaving more jobs vacant?
You know, they're having a difficult time trying to find the folks to be able to fill those positions. And, you know, we've got an aging, particularly if you look at nursing, we've got an aging workforce, and COVID really accelerated some of those retirements. So we're going to have to be looking at creative solutions and how to get folks into the workforce. I'll give you an example. We actually launched the first in the state, the first in the Midwest, of a nurse apprenticeship program here in Wisconsin. And I am just so excited about it. It is taking the certified nursing assistants from a healthcare system, paying them full-time wages, paying them full-time benefits, paying for them to go to school with their tuition covered, and they're going to be able to graduate with a family-sustaining job as a registered nurse with no debt. That is so exciting to me as somebody who has gone through nursing school. I want to make sure that we can have folks who may not have thought this was an option for them because they couldn't take themselves out of the workforce to get further education. And we're going to have some highly skilled, highly intelligent clinicians moving forward, and they're not going to have that burden of student debt.
How do you build on that RN apprenticeship pathways program this year, or what could the task force do to take it to the next level?
So that is one option for us to be able to look at. I know when I've talked to different healthcare systems across the state that they all have some innovative programs that they're working on. It's not just nurses in the hospital. We've got surgical techs. We've got ultrasound techs, registered dietitians. We've got all sorts of people that we need to make sure that the hospital works. And some of them have a shorter on-ramp than others for their education. So looking at that comprehensively is something that I know the task force is going to be really excited to work on.
We're talking about the governor's new task force on the healthcare workforce. Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez is with us, the newly appointed chair. And Lieutenant Governor, let's turn to hospitals. Last month, Hospital Sisters Health System and Previa Health announced plans to close locations in western Wisconsin. And HSHS said more than 1,400 employees would be affected. Do you anticipate the task force to discuss closures like this?
So we are going to be looking comprehensively across the state on anything that we can have an effective change on. And we know that that was a devastating closure for that community. But we have been involved. The governor's been in Eau Claire. They have done listening sessions. The secretary of the Department of Health Services has been there. Department of Workforce Development has been there to make sure that these highly skilled workers are going to be able to find positions within their area. And we're confident that we're going to be able to work with different healthcare systems to make sure that people have a soft landing. But not only that, is that the individuals who were getting their care at HSHS are able to transition cleanly and appropriately to other healthcare systems so that they can get the care they need where they live.
What is the greatest challenge coming out of these listening sessions? What are you hearing?
So, you know, what we're hearing is that this was a sudden decision for that community. And Governor Evers has said that he did not like how this was implemented and how this was done. I agree with him on that and has made that clear to the administration of these hospital systems. We need to make sure that these folks had more warning that this was going to happen so that we can make that transition more smooth and effective.
The dean of UW-Eau Claire's College of Nursing and Health Sciences was on our show after the closures were announced. And let's listen to Kristen Abbott Anderson on how to strengthen the nursing profession.
Nursing schools need to see each other as partners in this effort. There has been a great deal of, you know, competition. I think that's normal. But I think we need to begin to shift that focus on the fact that we have a common goal.
That we have a common goal. Do you think nursing schools in Wisconsin need to improve their relationships?
So I think nursing schools in Wisconsin, I often see them speaking to each other, working together, particularly within the UW system. And Governor Evers has put in his budget some things that are going to be helping the school system. He's put in loan repayment programs or actually grants for nurses to be able to get their PhDs so we can increase the number of nursing professors. And the requirement is they stay here in Wisconsin. And so those are the kind of solutions that we can look at that are going to affect all the nursing schools all across the state.
When does the task force expect to produce its recommendations to the governor? What is a timeline for this work?
So we're really looking at being able to provide some of those recommendations by September. So he has an opportunity to be able to look at this and see what pieces of it that he'd like to include within his budget. There may be some solutions that are administrative that we're going to be able to work with the secretaries for DHS and for workforce development that we can implement quite quickly to be able to streamline some of these areas for increasing the healthcare workforce. Some of them may require some budget considerations, and some of them may require some legislation. So I'm looking forward to working in a bipartisan way with the Assembly and the Senate, because as we know, healthcare is nonpartisan, and we want to make sure, all of us want to make sure that people can get the care that they need.
You travel the state in your role as Lieutenant Governor. I think you visited all 72 counties last year. How does healthcare rate among other pressing issues that Wisconsinites are talking with you about?
So healthcare is really on the top of the list. People want to make sure that they can get the care that they need where they live. And that is something that people are talking to me about. But there are other issues across the state that Governor Evers has been trying to address that affect our workforce challenges. So if we look at something like housing, if we want to be able to bring folks into the state, they need a place to live. And so we have to make sure that we have housing that's available across the state that's affordable for people to be able to live there. Looking at childcare, there are many folks who have taken themselves out of the workforce because they cannot afford childcare or there are no spots available to them. So looking at this comprehensively is going to be really important for the state of Wisconsin.
And it seems like as you look holistically, it gets into so many other areas beyond childcare, beyond healthcare, excuse me, and beyond the workforce. So how do you know how to prioritize and you know, how, what this task force can actually take on and achieve?
So we're going to be looking at data first and foremost. As somebody who's a nurse themselves, I consider myself a scientist, and we have to make sure we've got the data on where we're seeing those shortages and what the pipeline looks like. That's the first task of this task force. And then we're going to be looking at how can we prioritize these areas? What are we going to be looking at for the future? Where are our biggest gaps? What do we need to do to move forward? But looking at some of those basic needs for our workers here in Wisconsin is also going to be something that I know that the governor is really supportive of and something that he's already put in his budget in the past. And it's something that we need to revisit for the future if we want to make sure we can attract people to the state of Wisconsin as well as keep them here.
Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That, again, is Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez. We spoke Friday about her role leading a new task force studying challenges in Wisconsin's healthcare workforce. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin and our neighbors boast the nation's highest concentration of robotics in manufacturing. That's according to a paper published last year by the National Bureau of Economic Research. The study also found factories that use mini robots tend to have more employees than factories without robots. To learn more about this workforce study, we spoke last year with Robert Siemens, an associate professor at New York University, and I asked Siemens how robots could be expanding jobs.
It turns out that factories that adopt robots see a subsequent increase in employment. So we see that in the U.S. We see that in other countries as well. So researchers that have gotten access to data from Canada, France, Spain, they all find that relationship.
Does your research then refute the concern that robots take jobs from people?
Well, it's interesting, in part, but not necessarily in whole. Mm-hmm. It certainly raises questions, right? Again, the popular narrative is that robots take jobs, and what the pattern in the data suggests that firms that are adopting robots see an increase in employment. But this comes with some caveats. So one of the caveats is that while we see this correlation in the data, it's really hard to say that it's causal, right? So it's really hard to say that adoption of robots causes more jobs. So that's one caveat. The second caveat is that it does look like the nature of the jobs themselves are changing, right? So the firms that are adopting robots, at least what we see in the U.S., it looks like there's a shift from manufacturing employment to non-manufacturing employment.
To non-manufacturing employment. So what would that sector be? Can you give some examples?
Yeah. So that would be, for example, sales and marketing would be one example.
Oh.
Another might be R&D or basic research. The exact nature of these jobs could vary depending on the nature of the work that's happening at the firm. Honestly, there's, if anything, this research raises a lot more questions rather than answering questions. And so one of them is exactly what you're getting at, which is, well, how exactly does the nature of work change when firms adopt robots? And we know a little bit at a high level, but there's a lot more we're still trying to uncover.
Well, let's tease out a bit. Touchdown in the upper Midwest, where Wisconsin is among the top five states you identified using the most robots in manufacturing. Why is that?
Well, that's right. So the top five are Iowa, Michigan, Kansas, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. These are the states that have the largest concentration of robots. And most of that is because of manufacturing, and in particular, because of manufacturing in the automotive industry. So that industry currently has the largest amount of adoption of robots.
And what has the automotive sector done differently than other manufacturing areas? Why has there been such an adoption in making vehicles?
That's a good question. Again, it's not solely automotive manufacturing. We also see it in electrical components, for example. Also, plastic. Yes, and some of this, by the way, is sort of upstream from auto manufacturers. So it might be plastic injection molding and things like that. Mm. I think part of the reason is just that the automotive industry, actually tends to be a little bit of a technology forward industry in manufacturing relative to some of the others.
Rob, that you say that the robotic industry is highly skewed. About 10% of American metro areas use 75% of all robots. What makes these robot hubs highly concentrated?
Yeah, it's an interesting finding. And let me just add a little bit to it. So a moment ago, we were talking about reasons why states like Wisconsin have a lot of robots. Here, when we're talking about these, what we call robot hubs, we're actually trying to control for the presence of certain industries, so for example, automotive, and controlling for the number of employees in an area. Even conditional on all of that, it turns out that there are some areas that just have a whole lot higher adoption of robots than other areas. There are a range of reasons for this that we have started to explore. But again, just like I said about it, 5 minutes ago, there are also lots of questions. There are lots of things that we don't yet have the answers to that we continue to dig in on.
It was interesting how you found like this robot clustering and these integrators, having local robot integrators. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. So these integrators seem really, really important in explaining what's happening. So a robot integrator is a third-party firm that helps manufacturers identify what types of robots are out there, as well as what other types of companion technologies are out there. And they help the manufacturer, identify these technologies and then install them in their production line. So that's what a robotic integrator does. And these robot hubs that we were talking about a moment ago, so it turns out that one of the biggest factors that explains why some areas are a robot hub and other areas are not is the presence of one or more of these robotic integrators that help the manufacturers.
When you have these integrators, they work in perhaps clusters because, you found that some companies that were located in the proximity to other companies with using robots in their manufacturing processes, that they, that they were kind of building out from there, that companies in proximity were also using robots. What did you find there about that type of clustering?
It turns out that areas where you see more adoption, other manufacturing firms in that same area then become more likely to adopt. We think that might have to do with a couple of things. One is just a sort of a knowledge effect, right? So you see your competitor or your friend who owns a factory down the street who's adopted a robot. You see some of the success that has come with that, and then you, as the owner of a firm, might be more likely also to adopt. So there's sort of this contagion effect, perhaps. Mm. So that'd be one explanation. Another explanation might be the presence of what we would call specialized human capital. So these would be individuals that could work at a manufacturing firm and understand the manufacturing process at that firm, but also understand how to operate a robot and understand how to work with the software that you typically need to also have in place when working with a robot. So it's this highly specialized human capital that isn't, you know, uniformly spread across the U.S. It just turns out that it's in certain clusters, certain areas in the U.S.
And that is Rob Siemens, an associate professor at New York University. We spoke last year about his study of robotics in manufacturing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss a new census of monarch butterfly numbers, habitat challenges, and the implications for Wisconsin ahead of spring migration. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Karen Oberhauser is founder and director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, professor emerita of entomology at UW-Madison, and previously directed its arboretum. Karen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be back.
So the World Wildlife Foundation citing that this year's monarch butterfly population data is the second lowest on record. What is causing the decline behind this year's numbers?
Well, lots of things affect the numbers of monarchs that make it to Mexico every year. Recently, the most biggest the biggest factor has been weather. So last year was a drought, as a lot of us know in Wisconsin. So dry years are very bad for monarchs, and especially as they were migrating south to their overwintering sites in Mexico. They went through extreme drought conditions in Texas. So those conditions make their milkweed host plants not as nutritious for them, and it also limits the amount of nectar that's available to them. And even before weather became a big factor, the amount of habitat that was available to monarchs for breeding had decreased a lot over the last couple decades. So on top of the decline in available habitat, we have weather conditions that were bad last year.
Okay, so we're going to unpack those two. But, you know, I just checked the U.S. Drought Monitor. Nearly 70% of Wisconsin is abnormally dry or experiencing drought conditions. What impact does that have when monarchs are here?
It's a huge impact. Monarchs depend on plants, and plants, as we know, depend on rainfall. So monarchs can only eat milkweed host plants. And in a lot of places, milkweed has a long taproot that can really get down into groundwater that's way below the surface. But in a very dry year, even that isn't available to them. So their milkweed host plants were dry and not as nutritious last year, and the nectar plants as well. So there are also impacts on the butterflies themselves. That's more heat-driven than rainfall driven. So in a very hot year, the monarchs live shorter lives. Their larvae have lower survival. And in some cases, we have more predators around because the predators can go through their life cycles faster. So there are just a lot of things that can impact monarchs that are weather driven.
Can you remind us the life cycle of monarchs and how long they live?
Sure. The life cycle of monarchs starts out with an egg. Eggs, as I just said, are only laid on milkweed plants, and they're an egg for 4 to 5 days. And then they're a caterpillar, which is when people start recognizing them, for about 9 to 12 days, depending on weather conditions. It goes faster if it's warmer. If it gets too hot, it actually slows down a little bit. But say an average of 10 days as a caterpillar. And then they're a chrysalis or a pupa for another about 10 days. And if they're a summer butterfly that does not migrate to Mexico, they live as an adult about 3 to 5 weeks. So from egg to adult is approximately a month, and then they're a month as an adult. So that whole lifespan for a summer butterfly is about 2 months. If they're a butterfly that migrates to Mexico, they emerge as an adult at the end of the summer after approximately the middle of August. And those butterflies don't reproduce in the fall. Instead, they save up their energy so that they can stay alive all winter. And it's those butterflies that migrate to Mexico and stay in Mexico all winter and then come back. They don't make it back to Wisconsin. They maybe get about halfway. So those butterflies will live 8 to 10 months as an adult.
So there's more than one generation of monarchs each year.
Yeah. So the monarchs that are alive right now that will be leaving the overwintering sites in Mexico next month are the last generation of last year. And then as those very same butterflies from last year move back up into the southern United States, they produce the first generation of the new year. And then that first generation moves up into their northern breeding range, which includes all of Wisconsin. And they go through two more non-migratory generations before the final generation of the year starts the cycle again by migrating back to Mexico.
Oh, thank you so much for that explanation. That really helps. Karen Oberhauser with us, founder and director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, as we discuss declining numbers of monarch butterflies and what can be done about it. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Karen, you've been researching monarch butterflies since the 1980s. How typical are yearly fluctuations with the population?
Like many insects, monarch populations fluctuate a lot from year to year. They can go up and down by 100% or even more than that. So
Wow.
they declined last year by that much. So that's very common because, like so many other insects, monarchs are really driven by the weather. But the problem is when you have a species that can go through those huge fluctuations from year to year. When they're fluctuating around a low number, as they are now, that means that a big decline could drive them down so far that it would be difficult for them to recover. So you can kind of imagine an EKG of a very unhealthy person that's bouncing up and down in an irregular way. And what's important to monarchs is how kind of what the average is around which the population is bouncing. So right now it's low, and we can get things like happened this year with the population getting down to almost a dangerously low level.
Wow. At what point is the monarch butterfly population at risk of extinction?
Well, luckily we don't know that right now because it's never happened. As you said at the beginning, the population is now the second lowest it's ever been. So we measure kind of the size of the whole population by the number of hectares of land that are occupied by trees that have monarchs on them in Mexico. So we don't actually take a true census of monarchs. We measure the area that they cover. And this year it's 0.90 hectares, which is about 2.2 acres. Now that's less than 2 football fields. So that means that all of the monarchs from this huge area in the northern part of the United States, kind of imagine the northeastern quarter of the United States, all of those butterflies are in an area in Mexico right now smaller than 2 football fields. So it's scarily low.
Wow. Let's take a call now. Rana joining us from Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good morning. This is an exciting program. About 20 years ago, my daughter and I had an opportunity to travel to Mexico, and we went into the mountainous area in the specific pine tree area where those monarchs all migrate to and congregate. And it is by far one of the most fabulous things I've ever seen or heard, more specifically, with all those little fluttering wings. But my question is, what about their habitat in Mexico? I thought I had read that there was a lot of habitat destruction going on. Can you speak to that, please?
Rana, thank you. Karen.
Yeah. So first of all, that's wonderful, Rana, that you got to go to those overwintering sites 20 years ago. If you went now, you would be really surprised at how different they are, because that's when I started going as well, a little more than 20 years ago. So it's very noticeable, the decline. And we, for, as far as habitat destruction in Mexico, the Mexican government and the states in which the monarchs overwinter and the local municipalities are working really hard to protect those sites. So those sites are legally protected from logging. There is still some illegal logging that occurs, but it's been curtailed a lot. I think some of the biggest damage right now to those areas is, unfortunately, the number of people that are coming every year. There's a lot of dust that is blown up. So there's some, not necessarily destruction, but degradation that's going on in Mexico. But when we look at where habitat destruction actually has an impact on the number of monarchs, it's habitat destruction in the breeding grounds. So it's important. We need the habitat everywhere, where they breed, where they migrate, and where they winter. But right now, the biggest correlation with monarch numbers is the amount of breeding habitat that's been lost up here. What? So we really need to work on that, as well as to continue to protect those sites in Mexico.
What makes a habitat a beneficial breeding ground?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a great breeding ground has the plants that the monarchs need, milkweed and nectar sources. It doesn't have exposure to pesticides, especially insecticides that in most cases kill all insects and not just the target insects. And it's protected. So the nice thing about monarch habitat is it can be as small as your backyard, or it can be a pristine prairie of hundreds of acres. So monarchs can use those two ends of the spectrum. Putting habitat in your backyard can help them. And on a larger scale, of course, having much more habitat available to them is more beneficial. So looking into how we can encourage farmers to put their land in set-aside programs that allow the return of native plants to the area is important. But whether it's a little tiny garden or a huge prairie, it needs nectar plants, so a diverse variety of flowering plants and a variety of milkweed plants.
And it all helps regardless of the size. I think what I'm hearing you say as well, Karen Oberhauser, Professor Emerita of Entomology, previously led UW-Madison's Arboretum. Be part of the conversation about monarchs. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the decline in monarch butterflies and how to better support the population. We heard from Shannon in Oshkosh this week about prioritizing native plants.
We really need people to focus on bringing native plants back to the landscape. We're losing a lot of species, a lot of insects like monarch butterflies and bumblebees. And when you put those plants in, they're specialists. They actually need those native plants in order to survive.
We have Karen Oberhauser, Professor Emerita of Entomology at UW-Madison. Let's go to Mark in New Berlin. Mark, hi, what is your question?
Hi. Hey, you're talking about the monarchs that live east of the Continental Divide in the United States and Canada. There's a group of monarchs that live west of the Continental Divide in America, California, Oregon, Washington, and some of the other states. And they migrate to Monterey, California, and to Carmel, California, where they have parks in the cities and they have warnings not to drive and kill the butterflies, watch how you're driving and everything. How are they doing it? It's been a while since I've been there, and I'm wondering how those butterflies are doing.
Mark, thank you. Karen?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Mark. There are two fairly separate populations of monarchs in North America, as you indicated, although some of the monarchs from west of the Rocky Mountains do actually go to the overwintering sites in Mexico. But you're right that there are many. There are actually over 100 different overwintering spots along the coast of California and even down into Baja California, where most of the monarchs west of the Rocky Mountains overwinter. And those populations are also in decline. The numbers this year were lower than they were last year. They have some of the same issues with bad weather conditions, long-term drought west of the Rocky Mountains in their breeding ground. So yes, there is a separate population, and I'm glad that you've gotten to see those butterflies. It is very interesting to look at them because it's so different from Mexico, where, as you said, lots of them are in city parks, so they're very, very accessible. Instead of walking for hours, you can park in a parking lot and walk to see them. So yes, there are monarchs. Those monarchs do breed in several states that are east of California and north. So their migration is kind of, when they migrate in the spring, they're going sort of east, northeast, where the butterflies that come up to here are going pretty much north and then also a little bit east to get to the East Coast. So it's a shorter migration that those butterflies undertake, and also slightly different directionally.
Okay. Rita from Middleton called in and is wondering, is it beneficial to raise monarchs in homes and in classrooms? Rita does this and knows others who do it too. Is this beneficial?
So that is a very controversial question right now, Rita. From one perspective, it is beneficial to raise monarchs because you're raising people's awareness of them. So when kids get to see monarchs in their classroom or at their kitchen table or their grandma's kitchen table, they're making a connection to this insect that can be very important and beneficial for monarchs. The more people feel a connection to monarchs, the more likely they are to be to help them. But I would recommend, if you are trying to save the population of monarchs, a much more effective thing to do is to provide habitat for them as much as possible. It takes a lot of time to rear monarchs well, and we are never going to rear enough monarchs to really make a difference to the population. There's actually been some recent research that suggests that the monarchs that we rear, unless we're very, very careful about exposing them to natural light conditions, natural temperature fluctuations, that monarchs that are reared at the end of the summer are less likely to migrate successfully. So there's been a lot of research and a lot of conversation among monarch scientists now. I think for the most part, almost all of us would agree that mass rearing, so the numbers of monarchs that are reared by people who sell them, is problematic, because that can really, really make the conditions that the monarchs face during their rearing so different from what they would face in the wild that they just won't do well. Mm. In my opinion, I'm expressing a lot of people's opinions right now, but in my opinion, it's fine to raise a few. I do. I have every summer raised from 5 to 20 monarchs. I have them in a place in my house where they get natural light. I don't turn the lights on in that room after it's dark outside. So I'm really careful about light exposure, and I'm raising them. I'm reporting the results. I keep track of their survival and report it to us, the citizen science project that Kate mentioned, the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. So we're learning more about monarch survival. So the answer to your question about rearing monarchs and whether it's good or bad really depends on the conditions under which you're rearing them, the number that you're rearing, the time of year that you're rearing. And if you're using that information about the results of your rearing to help us understand more about monarchs. Yeah. So if you are rearing, I would encourage you to look at the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, which is a citizen science project that's jointly run by the Arboretum and the Monarch Joint Venture, and keep track of where you collect those butterflies, how old they are when you collect them, and what happens to them. And then you would be helping us understand more about monarchs and thus how we can better help them.
Randy in Plum Lake wants to know, what is the best time to plant milkweed and other native plants that are beneficial to monarch butterflies?
You can plant those plants anytime. So as your guest, Shannon, mentioned earlier this week, native plants are great. You can get them as plugs at any of the many plant sales that are going on in the spring, including one run by the Friends of the Arboretum. You can get plants, native plants, from a lot of different places. You can collect seeds as long as you collect them from a place where it's legal to do so. So you can grow, you can plant them in the fall, either in your own plugs or just put them out in your garden. So if you plant plugs, the little plants, you can get them usually in May when all danger of spring is past, kind of when you would be planting tomatoes in your garden. So spring is a good time, but you can also do it in the fall as seeds or even the fall as plants. So anytime.
In our last few moments together, what do the monarch butterfly population reveal about our human priorities?
I think that is such a good question. While monarchs capture the attention of a lot of people for very many reasons, they're beautiful, they're impressive, monarchs really provide this connection to nature for us. And everything that we do to help monarchs is going to help a lot of other species. So I think that our love for monarchs really reveals this strong connection that people can have with the natural world.
Oh, Karen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was fun to talk. And thanks to all the people who called in.
Karen Oberhauser is Professor Emerita of Entomology at UW-Madison, former director of UW-Madison's Arboretum. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a Milwaukee meditation teacher's six-year journey of finding their way back to what matters most after losing meaning in everyday things. You can call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Cott is owner of Mind MKE. New book is called The Way Home, Discovering the Hero's Journey to Wholeness at Midlife. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's good to be here.
Well, let's talk about this time in your early 30s. You realize you lost your heart. What does that mean to you?
Well, I would say the initial discovery, there was sort of an epiphany moment. And the first realization was a sense of burnout, exhaustion, fatigue in life in general. But as I started to pull back the layers, I discovered that really it was this sense that I couldn't move through the world in the same way that I had previously, which was, you know, an obsession for achievement, chasing after perfection and the approval of others.
You said you were like producing on this hamster wheel and perfecting and performing. Why was that so tantalizing to you?
Well, I think there were multiple layers to that. One would be that as a culture, we really value those things. We love to celebrate those who are hustling and achieving. But as I started to look more deeply, there was also, you know, there's family and religious narratives that fed into that approach to life. And then just some personal things that really were my, I mean, really it was all mine to deal with, but some sort of things that I needed to confront in myself ultimately.
How can someone figure out if they have, you know, in your words, lost their heart? What is that, you know, coming to that recognition?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think really the key is to arrange your life in such a way that you can listen to your own life. We go at an insane pace so often, and we fill our lives with all sorts of activities, and we start to quiet out that inner voice. And so it's really important to find practices like meditation or journaling or walking in nature that will help you tune in to what's going on inside of you. And also, honestly, what happens if you don't make space for that, you're going to be interrupted in some way. Like your heart is going to speak up and say, hey, it's time to pay attention to me.
It makes me think about, you know, you were talking to your spouse about your aspirations and she told you to get quiet. How did that phrase change your life?
Oh, yeah, that was a good one. So we were walking on the campus, University of Washington, where we used to live in Seattle, and like the cherry blossoms were out, and we had just come out of, they have this amazing Hogwarts style library there. And yeah, I was getting all excited about this, the next level of a project that I was working on. And, you know, in the middle of this lovely afternoon together, I'm kind of scheming about what I will do and ask for her advice. And, you know, I was hoping she would just affirm my ambitious ways. And she just paused. And as so many times in our marriage, as this has been the case, she just had this incredible wisdom. And it was those two words, get quiet. And it was really one of those moments where these words were symbolic for a message that had been chasing me down for a long time. It was yet again another reminder to go inward, to slow down, to really try to be internally referenced as opposed to externally referenced, which is, you know, constantly trying to be reactive to the inputs and the noise and the commotion around me.
Ben Cott with us, author of The Way Home, as we talk about his new book on finding yourself in midlife. You can join in along the way. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ben, your journey, you know, involves you taking a four-month sabbatical. It involves leaving your old job. Are financial obligations a significant barrier to doing this type of self-work?
That is an incredible question. I mean, one thing, while my journey did include the gift of a sabbatical, so I was used to be an ordained minister, and one of the perks in that world, as it's kind of increasingly in other spaces, maybe in different spots in corporate America, maybe tech and whatnot, academia for sure, but sabbatical is one of them. So my family took that opportunity to travel around the country and see people, and it was an incredible gift. So having had that experience was amazing, but I'm also, it's really important for me to say, like, look, you don't need to like eat, pray, love your way around the world. You don't need to go on some exotic journey, like externally or in the world. You actually can go on the inner journey from the comfort of your own home. I mean, there's, you know, whether it's wandering through your neighborhood park or, you know, meeting up with a trusted friend at a local cafe or deep dive in journaling or therapy or things like that. There's all sorts of ways that we can go on this journey that don't necessarily require, you know, having a ton of money in the bank account. But I will say that going on the journey can challenge some of our, you know, our sense of security and stability as far as finances are concerned. And there may be ways that we're clinging to those things a little bit too much, as we often do in this culture, that we need to kind of challenge that so we can open up space for new versions of ourselves to emerge.
But letting go, you know, that ability to let go doesn't have to be like quitting your job without another one waiting or moving across the country. It can be in the little things as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's very important for me in the book, especially to mention that, I mean, my own letting go, it's like I had to let go of something before ultimately it led to, say, a job change. So I was in a job that I was not satisfied in. I didn't feel, but that actually was part of what challenged me, is like I had tied up my identity and like the work I do is sort of novel and impactful and significant and I'm achieving things. And You know, suddenly I was in a job where I didn't feel like any of that was happening. And so the easy thing to do would have been to, quote unquote, let go of that job and leave it. But it was actually in the staying in the job that was difficult, that, you know, it challenged some of my patterns that were hindering me in terms of my own growth. So I had to let go of kind of that deeper tie and allegiance to those things we mentioned earlier, the achievement, perfection, and, you know, up getting up the approval of others. I had to let go of that. Eventually, things on the surface of my life changed, like the job changed. But I think sometimes we want to start with the surface level thing. Like you said, we want to move or we want the job change. But really, that might just mask the inner work that we need to do.
You were a pastor before your journey of self-discovery. And by the end of this time, you leave the church and you ultimately pursue a new career path. What was that like to leave the church and that, you know, that not only is your livelihood, but it is really the center of who you are, your soul?
Yeah. So I am so grateful for all the years I had as like a pastor. I started a church in Seattle, and some of my closest friends to this day were a part of that endeavor. And so it's sort of an interesting thing, because while I did let go of maybe the external aspects of that religious identity, in terms of my ordination status or the role and the profession, when I look back at the story, and I think this also comes through in the book, it's like I see this incredible continuity that throughout my calling or my sense of purpose, I've always felt like spirituality and community or belonging and social healing, social change. It's kind of my work and my calling has been at the intersection of those things. So while externally that's changed now, and I do coaching and I teach meditation as well as a few other things, there feels like there is this continuity between it. But yeah, it is. It's really hard to leave something, especially when it's like it's your career and there is such a sense of belonging. And in the religious space, when you leave something, that can be hard for other people, because it brings up all sorts of questions for them. So, yeah, you know, I think a lot of that is still probably working itself out in my life. But when I look back at all of it, I just am filled with gratitude for that part of my story.
Ben Cott, his book is called The Way Home, as we discuss personal development. You can call in with a question. You can share your insights along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A spiritual coach in Milwaukee uses a combination of solitude and wandering in the wild, meditation, and more techniques to find inner peace. Ben Cott's new book documenting this six-year journey, it's called The Way Home, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Ben, throughout the book, you cite author Joseph Campbell, who first dubbed the term hero's journey. Can you explain who was Joseph Campbell and how did he inform your enlightenment in midlife?
Yeah, so Joseph Campbell was a mid-20th century mythologist. So he studied myth and religion from across, you know, culture and time and place. And as he did that, in interacting with the work of others, he discovered this common pattern or this storyline, this monomyth, as he often talked about it, that he said runs through all of these ancient stories. That's what he called the hero's journey. And it really has, he had like 17 steps, so I won't go through all of those, but he had three main stages. And he talked about departure, initiation, and return. And so when I was emerging from this journey in my own life and started to reflect back, and it was really the early stages of this book, I had been interacting and studying Campbell's work. And it was like a light bulb went off. I was like, this is what I went through. This is exactly what I experienced. And so knowing that his work is, some of it's kind of inaccessible, like it's, you know, these big old tomes that most people aren't going to read. And yet people are familiar with his ideas because it ended up impacting like Hollywood movies. George Lucas, for example, Star Wars really borrowed this pattern as he wrote like the Luke Skywalker story. Many others have as well. But I started to say, what would it look like to use this as a lens to tell my story so that I could help everyday people who are going on this inner journey? And so in my book, there's three stages. I talk about them as leaving the familiar, falling into the unknown, and rising to wholeness.
And it's so interesting because you're very transparent about going through these different aspects. I'm just wondering, when you went through this journey, at what point did you think about, you know, turning it into a book or really being transparent with a lot more people than maybe just your family and tight circle?
Yeah, you know, I'm laughing right now because I'm wondering, you know, the book comes out today. I'm like, am I going to have a vulnerability hangover tomorrow? Like, I'm very excited that people are going to be reading it. Like, I'm really excited. And also, I'm like, what have I done? You know, so yeah. I will say that, like, when I started writing, it was a part of just reflecting on my own journey. And then I was like, okay, I think I'm writing a story. And maybe I'll share it with my kids, my wife, mm-hmm. people close to me. But after a few months, it started snowballing. And I was like, this is like a thing. This is a book. And I spent about a year and a half on my own writing it. I'd get up early in the morning. And, you know, amazing to have a supportive partner who'd like, you know, take point on getting the kids out the door. But I'd write before work. And, you know, I really was like, I need to finish this. So I wrote the whole book, a manuscript, without having anyone look at it, which is, they tell you not to do that. And without even thinking, oh, I need to go get this published. I just knew I needed to pay attention to the craft. And, you know, since you've read it, to like part of it, I was working out my own story is, can I make this thing and enjoy it and delight in it without the sense of I need to have it become something huge, right? Mm-hmm. So just being in that. So I would say there's been multiple stages of like, now, okay, people close to me have read it or getting endorsements. And, you know, I'm just aware that like if my story, which in many ways I feel like is very ordinary, if I can share that and it can impact someone, I think the vulnerability or the openness, it's all worth it.
I appreciated that you would turn to someone named Tal Tim and keep coming back to someone who would be able to be a really deep listener for you and also kind of like this pillar as you went through this mm-hmm. process. Can you talk about, you know, who people can turn to in going through this discovery?
Yeah. So the second chapter is called Get Help. And I think it's really important to remember that any inner journey, while ultimately it's something like only you can do, no one else can do it for you. You can't live vicariously through any podcaster or preacher or guru or influencer or whoever, author. Like, you have to do it. And yet, guess what? You're not isolated. You're not alone. Not only have people been on this before or people are going through it now, but there are people who will come alongside you and support you. And they're an essential part of this journey. So help is important. And I talk about this Celtic idea. This is Celtic Christian. So coming out of like Ireland back in the day, this idea of the Anam Cara, which means soul friend. Mm. A soul friend is really someone, I think this is a beautiful term, but it's someone who is like a mirror. They're a safe space for you, and they're a mirror who can reflect back to you the truest parts of who you are. Now, there's going to be a way in which at times when you need to be comforted, they'll do that. But there's other times where, guess what? Like, your narratives and patterns need to be disrupted. And so they also bring that. Like, they are someone who's fiercely there for you so that you can become your fullest, truest self. And so Anam Karas, these soul friends, come in all kinds of forms, and they can be your partner, or they can be a dear friend, could be a therapist, or could be like a spiritual community or AA group. For me, it was a spiritual director or spiritual companion, which not everyone's familiar with that, but essentially these are people who are, you could say they're professional Anam Karas. They hold space for you to kind of reflect on your life in terms of the different things you're experiencing and the version of you that's emerging.
Ben Cott is with us, author of The Way Home, as we talk about finding yourself in midlife. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ben, you have this mantra, grace, space, and pace. Can you explain, what do those words mean in this journey?
Yeah, you know, I got to make sure that I make a disclaimer so I don't get sued. But those are not my words. What's amazing is they came to me, and it's a story that's in the book, and it's kind of this twisted tale. But like one morning, as I was like in the early stages of this burnout, and I was like, I need to do something different. Like I can't keep going at this pace. I can't keep operating in this way. And it was a, believe it or not, like a 1950s, 1960s. We're talking like Mad Men era Jaguar ad that was in a magazine. I came across it on the internet, and it's gray space pace, which of course means for them like elegant and spacious, roomy and fast for this car. But as soon as I saw those words, I was like, these are for me. And so yeah, it has become in that sense a mantra, something that can keep calling me back to really at its core, a different way of moving through the world, which prioritizes you know, my inner life and this sense of being connected to my true self. So, you know, for grace for me was just learning to receive from others, and whether that's hospitality or the kindness of others. Space was just like not, you know, being so jam-packed with my schedule, like making space to take solitude or intentional aloneness for myself. And then pace, obviously, unlike the car, which is speed up and be fast, this was about slowing down. And so I had to, you know, found ways to slow down in my life. And I think all three of those were really the foundation for my journey, and they're practices I carry with me to this day. And also I think they're essential for anyone who wants to get their heart back.
In the perhaps in the space category, maybe I really appreciated how you would find these spaces in your life and in the world, in nature, and know that they were like a little sacred place that you would go to think and to be alone. I think they were like spot of time, or
Yes,
can you elaborate on that?
so William Wordsworth, the poet, he had this term called a place, a spot of time. It's a spot of time if it's a place that has like a renovating virtue. It's like a place that renews you. Like, and you know, even as you're listening to this, like maybe not if you're driving, but you could close your eyes and you could visualize a place that you know it's like that is rejuvenating place. And it could be in the middle of like, say, you know, we're in Wisconsin, could be up north somewhere in the middle of the woods, or it could be a cabin on the lake, or it could be this particular bend in the trail at your neighborhood park, maybe even a specific tree that just has like captivated you every time you walk by it. These are places that, whether we're in seasons of like that are incredible, filled with like joy and goodness, or we're in, you know, dealing with grief and despair and loneliness, when we come back to these places, really, nature through us connecting, like it shows us something about who we are. Or there's a comforting aspect of it. It can anchor us in a world that's always changing, and maybe in those moments where everything's falling apart, we can come back to what is. Because at the end of the day, like whatever that spot in nature is, it just is. It's being what it needs to be. A stream is streaming, or the tree's being the tree, and it helps us come back into our essential self as well.
Have you found a spot of time in Milwaukee?
Absolutely. So, but if I tell everyone, they're gonna join me
Okay.
there. I mean, so I
Because
will just
I
say
was
this.
mourning for your spot of time being halfway across the country.
Yeah, you know, so I am going to Seattle this week, and I will absolutely visit that space. What's amazing about moving here is, you know, my wife's family's from Ontario, Canada, so we're both kind of Great Lakes people. I'm from the area here initially, Greater Milwaukee area, so we're very excited about the lake. Without giving away too many details, I'll just say, what surprised me and what I have fallen in love with is the Milwaukee River. There's these incredible trails that are pretty quiet. You know, there's a bunch of people fishing on them right now. But
Well,
like, I love going down there.
let's pause there with Ben Cott, Milwaukee native. The book is The Way Home. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore a meditation teacher's journey in slowing down and learning to listen to their inner compass. Ben Cott's six-year journey of personal development is now a guidebook. It's called The Way Home. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, you cite a concept from Yale Divinity School professor Willie James Jennings' book, After Whiteness, and you say people are suffering under three values that Jennings identifies in his book, possession, control, and mastery. What are the issues with these values?
Yeah, you know, he sort of ironically calls them, he takes it even a step further, he calls them virtues, you know, to express this way that sort of a lot of Western culture, you could say, has this allegiance to mastery, control, and possession. And I would say that I came across those words when I had been running a podcast and I had been in conversations with all sorts of people who were doing really important work in terms of working for justice and equality. And I realized that while, yes, I was working through some dynamics in my own life that got me oriented towards achievement and perfection and approval, that actually this was like this deeper cultural layer that was informing how I went about the world. And it's really, it's a hostile way of engaging things because we're trying to control or possess or take control of rather than really more like engage in a dance with life and be receptive and be vulnerable and be curious.
You mentioned as well that you think especially men are taught at a young age to be that strong and tough and self-sufficient. Does that impede on finding yourself? What about men at midlife?
Yeah, you know, one of the sort of playful things about the title of this book, which has Hero's Journey in the title, and that's obviously, as we talked about earlier, Joseph Campbell's work, there is a sense that I think if you're to talk about being a hero, it often conjures up in people's imagination this idea of the heroic individual, someone who's kind of on their own and accomplishing incredible things and swooping in to save the day. And so, interestingly, I sort of hope this appeals to people who maybe are drawn to that and is in a way, I'll say it here, which means maybe it won't be this anymore, but it's a subversive invitation. So we're drawn to this idea of being heroic and kind of being like the master of our life and what's happening. But there is actually inside of that in this story, in this path, there's like this invitation into gentleness and vulnerability. And so, yeah, like I think men especially, we build up all sorts of layers, and it's because of cultural narratives and family stuff and, you know, our own issues that we start to move through the world in a very particular way that shuts out the kind of help we need and that openness to just be more vulnerable and tender and be people who are in touch with our grief and our pain.
You have to be quite vulnerable going through some darkness in this journey. And I'm wondering if you can kind of explain the death lodge experience as you go through this kind of place of grief and then as well as gratitude.
Yeah, so the death lodge is a concept I first came across in the work of eco-psychologist Bill Plotkin, who's got this book called Soulcraft, which was a big companion for my journey. But one day I had a friend who facilitates these kinds of experiences, met up at local park. This is actually right where my spot of time is, that sacred place we were talking about earlier. But a death lodge is, it can be a real or imaginary place. But the idea is you essentially, when you're marking a season of severance from something, and that can be a relationship or a role, a job, you know, anything on the surface of your life, but more often kind of that deeper pattern of operating, whether it's, you know, perfectionist or controller or victim or escapist or whatever the thing might be that you realize is no longer serving you, a death lodge is a way of interacting with it and basically saying to this part of yourself, hey, thank you for what you've done, because actually that part worked to keep you safe or help you move through the world. But to be grateful for what that way of being entailed, and also grieve the fact that you're no longer going to have that as your center of gravity. And so often the things you're thankful for and you're grieving the loss of, those will be the same. But also with the grief, there will be other things, other aspects of that identity that have caused you pain that it's time to relinquish and say goodbye to.
Are there any types of ritual practices as you go through that processing that you would recommend or that helped you? I know you looked to poetry mm-hmm. as well in that time.
Yeah. So, you know, poetry, I think it's Audre Lorde says it gives name to the nameless so it can be thought. So mm-hmm. poetry can be a powerful companion because look, like I started writing some poetry just for myself. I share a little in the book. It's not too incredible. the point isn't to be like this incredible poet, but like both reading poetry and experimenting with your own is a way to surface some of those deeper things. So in addition to poetry, obviously journaling, as I mentioned, having this a particular place you go to, as we've talked about earlier, that's really important. All these things, they help us like see that even though we're on this inner journey, which sometimes like it can feel really murky and unclear, we start to notice like, oh, I've made progress. I am growing. Look how I'm showing up differently in my relationships or the new energy I'm bringing to my work. Like we start to see that because we're doing this inner work, we're kind of tracking and mapping like, okay, stuff's happening in the underworld that's starting to express itself like in our day-to-day lives.
We're talking about a new book on finding yourself in midlife. Ben Cott is with us, author of The Way Home. You can call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, you name your imposter with a capital I, imposter. And I'm just wondering about these, as you said, obsessions with producing and perfecting, but then you kind of shed your achievement imposter and you discover that there is also another layer, a mask. Can you talk about what was underneath that?
Yeah, so I would say underneath, kind of behind these, the three-headed monster, the achiever, perfectionist, performer, there was what I call the reverent, obedient cadet, which is a callback to this like kind of like a Boy Scouts group affiliated with my church that I was in when I was growing up. And let me tell you, I wasn't very good at any of the Boy Scout type stuff. But this thing, like I remembered this phrase, and there's a whole bunch of other kind of beautiful words like being compassionate and thoughtful, like all these things that come with it. But that became this reverent, obedient cadet, kind of became this really this tender identity that was behind all these things that was making me, kind of contributing to how I was operating. And what I mean specifically is there's a sense of like loyalty and allegiance, which are wonderful things. They're very important qualities. And there's ways that when we kind of start to lose ourselves and we become conformists who just kind of go along with the status quo and the way things are, and we start to shut off other parts of ourselves because we're trying to, you know, stay safe, fit in. And so we play small and we kind of shave off the wild edges that exist within all of us.
So I'm wondering, why did you leave Seattle? I mean, that was a hard time for you. Why did you move to Milwaukee, back to your home base, in a sense?
Yeah, you know, so in 2019, my wife and I had been thinking, you know, like all our kids, they were all born in Seattle. Seattle's their home. And we had this amazing community there. But we were thinking in 2019, we came in April to visit and it was snowing. And we're like, we're not moving. Okay. Not going to happen. But a year later, guess what? What was happening a year later in early 2020? Well, we weren't the only ones who were suddenly asking deeper questions about, you know, about how we're spending our days on this earth. And so we were really feeling that pull to be back closer to family, to be somewhere where there's maybe a bit of a different pace, especially as our kids are getting older. So moved back to Milwaukee in large part because I have a brother here. My parents are here. We're within a drive from my wife's family. It's a long drive, but it's doable. And yeah, really, I would say it was like for years earlier before that, I kind of been thinking, I got to get out of here. But when we finally moved, it didn't come out of a place of anxiety or forcing anything. It just felt really natural.
How did you find a new community in Milwaukee? Because you had found such a close-knit group around you of friends and colleagues who almost became like family to you. And I feel like I can relate Our family spent, years and years in Louisiana and also developed those really tight bonds, not with family, but with friends.
Yeah, you know, so a couple of things come to mind. First is we were fortunate to have my brother and sister-in-law like arms wide open when we got here, and then some other people that I'd known kind of growing up. But it was a challenging time to move because it was 2020, the height of the pandemic, and so really I would say it took a year or two before we started forging some new connections here. And some of it was, guess what I did during that time? I wrote this book. So the hibernating, it was a really lovely season. But there's sort of a different way, I would say, at least I'm approaching things here. I took a lot of responsibility. Like my work was building community. And while I love that, there was a certain cost to that. And I feel like here I'm just more open and responsive to those meaningful relationships as they've come. And guess what? It's happening.
Ben Cott is a meditation teacher, spiritual coach, and writer in Milwaukee. New guidebook for self-discovery. Call in with a question. You can share your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore a journey of self-discovery to gather wisdom and ability to face new trials, especially in a midlife transition. Ben Cott's new book is called The Way Home, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question. Bring your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Julia in Madison is here. Julia, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I've been listening with intrigue. I identify with a fair amount of things, but I also wondered if the author in his life experience has spent time in other cultures, and wondering if there's differences in terms of what he's talking about. Like, for example, I am middle-class white. The book Caste and the movie Origins explores things across cultures. And I was wondering his thoughts on African Americans and their journey, people of poverty in different countries, how their experience might be.
Julia, thank you. Ben.
Yeah, thanks, Julia. Appreciate your question. What I would say is the reason that these stories show up across time and place, and there's different accents and different shapes that they take, is because people for the longest time have been trying to make sense of this question of what does it mean to be human, and how do we live a life of meaning and purpose? And that's a question that people can ask regardless of their socioeconomic state. In fact, that's a question that people have always been asking. And so it's very important for me as I tell this story is that I think what can happen is this hero's journey, for example, it can get tied up in a lot of self-help spaces as something that is tied to a certain, that like finding yourself also means you're suddenly going to be wealthy and everything's going to go well for you. And that's not what I'm saying in the book. What I am getting after is this idea that no matter what you go through, no matter what adversity you face, which is different for people from different populations for sure, there is this strong inner self that no one can ever take away. And we see this in the stories of some of the people who, people across time who've suffered in incredible ways. And at the end of the day, it's up to each of us to stay in tune with that because no one else is really going to be advocating for that. In fact, that's where so much exploitation and oppression is happening. It's trying to separate people from their core essential self. But the most resilient people we've seen across time and place, they're always the ones who are staying connected to what is true, not only about themselves, but about what it means to be human and to belong to one another.
After your wilderness time, you felt like you had to deepen your meditation practice. And I just am curious, how has meditation changed you?
It's been an absolute game changer. I mentioned a bunch of ritual practices in the book, from journaling and time in nature to dream work and this death lodge and also fasting and other things. But I would say that the most foundational practice is meditation, which I teach in Milwaukee and beyond. I have a twice a day for 20-minute meditation practice. You know, I kind of think of it lately as like I'm microdosing solitude, and it's just getting that real a time each day to be recharged for the activity of the day. So sometimes people think meditation, it can be selfish, it can be an escape. But the reality is that like taking that, you know, 1 to 2% of your day, it can transform the rest of it. And it isn't about like becoming someone who's an incredible meditator with your eyes closed. It's really about how do you live fully and be more present and be someone who's, you know, compassionate and seeking justice when your eyes are open.
Picking up on the fasting piece of this, you fasted for more than 4 days during the wilderness quest. What insight did fasting give you?
Yeah, you know, what's funny is I just looked at the books on Spotify, and like one of the headings is like health advisory. So I'll just repeat that here. Like there's a, you know, none of this is like if you're going to consider fasting, you should do your research and know what you're getting into. But for me, it was tied with a wilderness experience. And I've done other, you know, had other experiences with fasting. We see this across religious traditions, whether it's the Lent, for example, the Christian season of Lent that many are in right now, there's things that people are fasting from. Maybe it's eating certain things. Obviously, in Ramadan, it's this, you know, the worldwide population of Muslims are fasting in incredible ways from sunrise to sundown. So we see this across, you know, time because there's a transformative power. And so just to hit on a couple of what those things are, one, it can help us like actually access our grief. There's a sense that fasting happens when people are mourning. But another thing it does, it can in some ways alter our consciousness, or we could say that more gently, which is like open us up to the deeper conversation. And then also it just helps us see that like we're not tied to that like insatiable hunger or craving that we have, that there's something, it encourages us to go inward.
And then you were also trying to make sure you understood your dreams as well during that period of fasting. What were your dreams like?
Well, the one when I was fasting involved a, you know, a former president and, you know, kind of a song and dance routine. So you'll have to read it to get that full story. But that really, I guess I would say there's, you know, there's certain dreams that can feel like they give you clarity for like the next step, like a step you need to take, you know, something you need to shed, something you've outgrown. And really a basic tip for this is like keep a journal by your bedside, and when you first wake up, before checking your phone or whatever, just like you notice, like, is there like a lingering, like a remnant of a dream, and just scribble that down. The more you pay attention to that, the more you'll start to remember your dreams, and the more you'll be able to access meaning in your dreams. But then there's other, you know, there's other dreams that maybe aren't just for you. There's some, like, there's almost like a visionary quality to them that I think at the end of the day, it's calling you to love more fully, if I can just kind of put that heading over it.
So on this journey of self-work, you end up in Arizona where you hug and you cried for a cactus, a saguaro cactus. What did this experience teach you?
Yeah, what a strange story, right? You know, what's fascinating is I had this experience. I came across this later. There was like a speech that... whatever his name is, the actor who's Iron Man, who I actually mentioned. Who is that? Again, Tony Stark in Robert Downey Jr.
Right,
okay. He's giving a speech and he's talking about recovery, and he mentions Mel Gibson, whose name we really can't say, I guess. But Mel Gibson told him one day like that he just needed to hug the cactus. This is like a thing. And I never heard this before. I'd had my experience in the desert. I heard this later, but really hugging the cactus was like just engaging your pain and your brokenness and your woundedness and like just coming to terms with it. And I would say when I look back at, you know, this experience I had out in the desert where I really felt like I was in a conversation with this saguaro cactus, it was all sorts of things, but one was it was a massive expression of grief, not only my own grief for the ways I've failed others and hurt others, but also in a sense like this grief over the human condition in which we're estranged from one another, and which we take things out on each other and on the planet, and just think of all the horrible things going on right now and in any moment. And something about this encounter in the wild with this cactus was a way of processing this cosmic grief that we all carry.
You found bullets all around the cactus. How did that make you feel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was the thing. The cactus was like, felt like it was saying, I have a story to tell you, okay, which is kind of a weird thing. But when I started just slowing down, I noticed it had been like stabbed by this wooden stake. And then, yeah, I kind of, it was like part crime scene investigation, part like mystical conversation. And I found four different caliber bullets around this thing. And I noticed it was riddled with bullets. And, you know, the specific feeling I had was this heaviness. It's like, how many people had wandered up? And there's this thing called cactus plugging. You kind of just go shoot a cactus. But I wanted to, it was almost like I felt something beneath that. It was like this anger and this this hatred and this like isolation that somehow was being taken out on this cactus.
Mm. In our moments left from where we left the book, I understand those bullets are still near your writing desk.
They're right over my shoulder right
they're
now.
They're right over your shoulder. Do you, why did you take them? Why are they with you as you write and are, yeah, you know, in your life?
Yeah, so in my space here, this little corner office in the basement, which also is known as the laundry room, just depends on what angle you're looking at it. This is where I wrote the book. And I have all sorts of things, little like cards, like a mug with a cactus that says, can't touch this. It's from my kids. And I have a pine cone that's a memory of a story that I experienced during the season. And I have a carving of a jaguar, and I keep all these things to remind me of the journey that I've been on, not to like call me and keep me in the past, but to keep, you know, sending me into the future as someone who's trying to become more fully alive and make the most generative contribution to the world in which we live.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Kate, this was amazing. Thank you for spending time with my stories and for your curiosity.
Ben Cott is author of The Way Home, Discovering the Hero's Journey to Wholeness at Midlife. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.